Hello and welcome to this week's Convex Conversation with me, journalist Helen Fospero. You may recall our podcast with four young Marines, all in their 20s, who rode the Atlantic earlier this year. Their journey was hardcore, inspirational, grueling, and at times life-threatening as they faced wild storms, rough seas, and painful injuries. Well, today we're meeting grandfather Frank Rothwell, who, to mark his 70th birthday, tackled the ocean at the same time, only he was alone, rowing 3,000 miles by himself, a feat which has earned him the title of the oldest person to complete a solo crossing. There was method in Frank's madness. He raised more than £1 million for Alzheimer's Research UK for a very personal reason. He set off on the Talisker Whiskey Atlantic Challenge from Tenerife and made it in one piece to Antigua 56 days later. And can you believe it? Days ahead of schedule. Frank, I've been dying to talk to you and hear your story. I mean, not only did you make it, you arrived about a week early, didn't you?
I did, yes. My target was to arrive home by Valentine's Day, miles ahead of it.
I can't believe you were so far ahead of it. And is it true you were heard shouting for your wife of 50-odd years, Judith, as you came into land?
That's right. We have a little bit of fun, my wife and myself, about my tea. We have really good tea at our house. And now I shouted across the harbour, "Get my tea on this table!"
Now, your boat is called Never Too Old. I mean, age is just a number, right?
Age is just a number. It's just how you feel that this matters.
So, Frank, take us back to the beginning. Why did you take on the Atlantic by yourself and such an enormous challenge?
I've done a number of things in the past. I've been on the island with Bear Grylls when I was 67. I was the oldest person by 17 years when I was on that. I've also sailed quite a bit. I've sailed around the world in my own yacht. I've also sailed, circumnavigated North America. I've also circumnavigated South America. And there's only 10 people in the world ever done that, and I'm number 10. I'm the only person to do it in a figure of eight. I'm no stranger to challenges. And I've been looking for something for a while, and I couldn't find anything that was, like, difficult enough. And then one night in a pub, I met a young lady whose friend was rowing across the Atlantic solo. And after hearing her stories, I couldn't sleep that night. I got up at 3 o'clock and started looking on the internet to look what you had to do to actually join the race. And that was it. My wife came down at 3 o'clock and says, "What are you up to?" I said, "Well," so she looked at it, and that was it. She knew I was looking for something, and she says, "Yeah, it sounds all right by me." So I got the nod off Judith.
Is Judith a bit long-suffering, do you think? Because you're a bit of an adventurer, aren't you?
Well, yeah, she's long-suffering. She's confident in that I wouldn't take on something that I couldn't handle or was going to be too difficult.
And you also, Frank, took it on for very personal reasons. I mentioned in the introduction that you raised £1 million for Alzheimer's Research UK. Tell me a bit about Roger, your brother-in-law, and what inspired you to raise such an enormous amount for such a very important charity.
Raising funds for Alzheimer's research wasn't my initial motivation. My motivation was for me to row across the Atlantic. And it wasn't until I'd registered my interest that I realised that all the other people were actually raising money for a charity. I thought, "Oh, I need a charity. Who shall I support?" And I find that in life, that the older I'm getting, that the more and more people I'm finding are affected by Alzheimer's. And one of those people is my wife's brother, Roger, who's a Down syndrome person. And Roger hasn't been able to speak all his life. He gets along with gestures and two-syllable words. So I thought, well, it would be really fitting if I raise money for Alzheimer's. So I then had to try and find myself, start learning about Alzheimer's and learning about whom to raise money for.
And why did you choose Alzheimer's Research UK?
That's a fantastic question. I have a friend of mine, also affected by Alzheimer's, so I contacted him and he's no more. And I said, "Malcolm, I want to raise £1 million for rowing across the Atlantic. Can you put me in touch with the right charity? Because I don't want to get involved in raising funds for a charity that's only purpose is to keep the chief executive in a great lifestyle. I want to raise money and it make a difference." So Malcolm says, "You want to raise £1 million? He says, "To row across the Atlantic." He says, "I'll give you £500,000. "What?" They fell through the floor. "Well, I've not got a boat. I've not done anything. Just an idea." And this man's already said, "If you do that, I'll donate £500,000. It'll go to Alzheimer's Research UK. he says, then they're a proper charity. So started from there. But the thing is, well, I didn't see his eyes when he said this. So I thought, I'll phone him up again. I phoned him up again, and he says, come down and see me. So I went to see, Malcolm. And he says, I've changed my mind. I thought, all right, here we go. What we'll do, he says, I won't give you £500,000. He says, we'll use it as match funding. So everybody who puts a tenner in, I'll match it with a tenner up to about £500,000. I thought, that's a cracking idea. That'll really encourage other people to donate. And that's exactly what we did.
So you took about 6 weeks of rowing, but 18 months of training. What sort of things go into the training to get you ready to take on that kind of challenge?
Well, there's two types of training. First of all, there's the classroom training, which is about a week. You've got to learn about sea safety. It's all about safety. You've got to know how to navigate, how to deal with radio. Do you need a radio operator's license? Or you need to go to swim pool and do a sea survival course. There's all that, which takes about a week. And then there's also the training you've got to do in your own boat. And the race organisers demand that you spend 120 hours in your boat, which I thought was a lot, until I started doing it. And then I got really into this, rowing my boat, and eventually I did about 400 hours instead of 120. I did 400. I loved it so much, and did it in Scotland on the River Clyde. River Clyde is actually sea. I rowed all the way around the Isle of Bute about four or five times, and I was doing about 35 miles a day training. And I can't walk 35 miles in a day, but I can row a boat that weighs half a ton.
The thing that really puzzles me, particularly having spoken recently to four Marines, strapping lads in their 20s, who did 3 hours on of rowing, 3 hours off in pairs. I can't get my head around, Frank, that you were by yourself in those conditions. So how did you sleep? How did you keep going all the time? How did you manage alone?
First of all, it can only be done as a solo because the winds are favourable. We set off from the Canary Islands and we're going to go to the Caribbean. In the Canary Islands, the wind predominantly comes from the northeast, from the east or the northeast. And we want to go west, so the wind is behind you. And it comes from that direction about 95% of the time in the Canary Islands. So when you set off immediately, the wind is behind you. But because the wind's behind you, that's the way the waves go as well. Once you get farther south, you get about 500 or 600 miles farther south, the wind changes and it comes mainly from the east, again, for about 95% of the time. So the wind, again, is blowing you in the correct direction. So because the wind's blowing that way, that's the way the waves go as well. So that helps you along. But also there's something that we remember at school called the Gulf Stream. And the Gulf Stream is dead simple. All this is in the Caribbean, the sea gets pretty hot. It gets around 100 degrees Fahrenheit. Because it gets so hot, it leaks out of the Caribbean and the Gulf of Mexico and flows north up the coast of Florida and then comes right across the Atlantic, right north of Scotland. And as it's going along, it cools down and it turns south. And it eventually goes all the way down to the Canary Islands, past the Canary Islands, and then across the Atlantic again. So you've got this circular motion of ocean currents that can push you along at about half a mile an hour. In theory, if you sat in an old tin bath and took your shirt off and held it up, it'd blow you across the Atlantic. And that's what allows you to do it as a solo. When I was rowing, there was 3 days, once was Christmas Eve and Christmas Day, when the wind went absolutely flat calm and started to blow me the wrong way, blowing me backwards. So I went to sleep at night, and when I woke up in the morning, I'd gone 8 miles backwards. So I've got to row for 3 or 4 hours to actually get to back to where I was when I went to bed. So that's difficult.
And what was the weather like? I mean, did you encounter any rough seas and storms on your trip?
Roughest seas I saw was probably 4 metre waves. Then the waves started to break a little bit, that wind strength, and we got about 4 or 5 blowing us along about 25 miles an hour, 30 miles an hour is most wind I saw. But mainly it was around about the 15, 16, 18 miles an hour wind, and that's perfect.
It sounds breathtaking. I mean, were there moments when you just pinch yourself and you're out there in the middle of nowhere, all you can see is sea and sky? It sounds quite incredible in many ways.
Well, you've got to realise is that when we were out there, COVID was in place, all air travel stopped, and I didn't see an aircraft for 5 weeks. The nearest people to me at one time was the people in the International Space Station. You know, that's, we were so far away, I didn't see a ship or anything for 3 weeks. did I feel frightened? I've sailed a lot, so I knew what to expect, and I never got to the stage where what I'm thinking to myself, what am I doing this for? I was never in that state of mind. I never got really frightened because I knew what to expect, and I knew that the quality of the boat I was in, and the race organisers make sure that everything about what you've got is going to make it safe. They don't want anybody to die while they're going on this race, so they are thorough, absolutely thorough in the safety. I can't praise them enough with the things they put in place.
And how do you cope with the solitude, Frank, without Judith making you tea and everything?
I've been married for 50 years to Judith. Judith is a lovely lady. 50 years this year. And we had to cancel our, we were going to have a big party for 300 people. And, oh, we've got the Beatleg Brutals.
That's a new one on me.
we've got two rock bands. We had two brass bands. We have a real full-on day. And we had to cancel that, you know. Judith can cope without it. It was no tears. But so while I was away, I really missed Judith. Even though I spoke to her three times a day, when on Christmas Eve and Christmas Day, I was a bit teary, you know, and when I left, set off, I was a bit teary. And also, just before I arrived there, I was a big softy, really. And so how do you cope with it? Well, if you think of the end game, what are we doing, you know? What's it all about? I'm raising awareness for really worthwhile charity as well as my own personal gain of going across the Atlantic solo.
You got the news, sadly, that Roger passed away, didn't he, while you were at sea?
I loved Roger. I always liked to think that we had a special relationship. But when Roger was about 8 years old, I came on the scene as a teenager, and he didn't have an older brother, and he used to idolise the things I did at the time. I was a tractor mechanic, and we bought him a big Tonka tractor, you know, and oh, I could talk to him, ask him where was the driver's seat and where was the front wheels and where was the engine and where was the back wheels. And he knew exactly what I was talking about, even though he couldn't communicate. His mother and father had a caravan. He learned to ride a two-wheeler bike, which is fantastic. He had to ratchet the wheels. His feet couldn't go full circle. And everybody loved him and said, hello, Roger. He went past, you know, and everybody made him feel special. He died at 60. And when I started going out with Judith, it was explained to me that people with Down syndrome, it's unusual for them to get past late teens or into the 20s. And Roger, because of the health service, he actually lived to be 60, 62. And he had two lives. He had his life while he's living with his parents. His parents died. And then he lived in a home, and they looked after him. They made his life a real pleasure, you know, and lived with his own little community. The second 30 years was also spot on for him.
So when you heard that, sadly, he had passed while you were at sea, did that just spur you on even more to complete it and do really well, Frank?
I didn't realise he was so close to dying at all. You know, all of a sudden it just seemed to happen. I was a real motivator, and I thought, yeah, doing what I'm doing now, I will hope it will make a real difference.
And other people got in touch, didn't they, while you were on your voyage? Other people who have had loved ones and family members suffering from dementia?
Yeah, I didn't want people to phone me while I was rowing, because once the phone rings, I've got to stop rowing. I've got to pack the oars. I've got to stand up and crawl across the boat, and if it's rough, then I've got to open the hatch, go into the hatch, shut the hatch, and then pick the phone up, and then the phone stops, doesn't it? And on these satellite phones, you can't say, redial, who's just for me? There's none of that. You know, the information you get is very basic. So I discourage people from phoning me except Judith. The agreement was that I phoned Judith three times a day, or if I wasn't going to phone her midday because she had something else on, but definitely twice a day. We got loads and loads of messages from people encouraging me and telling me about their experiences. And when I spoke to the people at Alzheimer's Research, they were picking up these Facebook messages and passing them on to me. Yeah, that's a real motivator.
Certainly is. So what did you find the biggest challenges, do you think?
The food. The food is the biggest problem. The race organisers have to cover every angle. They don't want to be responsible for anything going wrong, for not having enough water, for not having enough food. So they want us to take 60 calories per kilogram of body weight for every day. And they assume that it's going to take you 90 days. You've got to take 85 days of all that food, which is a lot of food. I thought I got a right variety, but oh, I got sick and tired of macaroni cheese. Oh, I never, ever, ever want to have macaroni cheese again. Do you know, I thought macaroni was an animal. I didn't know it had two legs or four legs.
And is it all freeze-dried, Frank? I mean, it's not the macaroni cheese that you might get down at the local Italian.
Oh, no, it's all freeze-dried. Some of the stuff was really, really good. You know, macaroni cheese is all right once or twice, but not three, four times a week. And twice a day some days, you know, so it's easy to make. Also, when you're at sea, you know, with the food, we change seawater into drinking water. We have a water maker which runs off electricity, which we may get from solar panels. And so we get plenty of water. We should boil the water to add it to the macaroni cheese. But you did that and it was ready in 5 minutes. But if you just put the normal water, the normal tap water in and left it for 20 minutes or half an hour, it was just the same because the seawater is 25 degrees. So my drinking water was always 25 degrees. So I only cooked one meal. The rest I just had it at the temperature of the water was I was drinking.
What about any nature? The Marines were followed by a school of tuna at one point and had a whale visit them. Did you see any incredible wildlife out there?
I saw very little. I've done quite a lot of sailing. Like I say, I've sailed 80,000 miles. There's not many people in the UK sail 80,000 miles. And if you're sailing up North Sea or the Irish Sea, it's quite normal for dolphins to come and come up to the boat and have a look and a play with you. If your boat's going fast enough, they like to ride on the bow wave at the front. While I was at sea, I had been at sea for probably a week, south of the Canary Islands. Everywhere I looked for 200 metres, all around the boat, there was dolphins in pods of half a dozen. There was hundreds and hundreds of dolphins. So I got my camera, the GoPro camera, which I put on the stick and pushed it in the sea to like see if I could film these dolphins underwater, which I've not seen it yet. A film company took the film away and they're making a documentary. So I've not seen this fantastic film I'm supposed to have done underwater with all these hundreds of dolphins. That happened on two consecutive days, this mass of dolphins. There were so many, I had to stop rowing or else my oars would have hit them. And then as quick as they came, they went. And just whether they dived down or just what happened, I just don't know. But they weren't there, they were there, and they were there for half an hour. And then they went. The same happened the next day. I thought, is this going to be a daily occurrence? But that was it. I saw, a minke whale, a white whale. It was about 15 or 20 metres from the boat on the surface. I've seen those before, heading west like me. There's a bird. I don't think it was a seabird that seemed to arrive every night about 4:30 or 5:00, circle around the boat quite a bit and then clear off and then it'd come back. And then one night it actually come into the cabin. I managed to pick this bird up and it had lovely, lovely soft feathers, really soft feathers. I opened the hatch and it flew away and I saw it again, but it never came on the boat again.
You know, the dolphins were a bit fed up of macaroni cheese. That's why they went elsewhere. The charity's CEO, Hilary Evans, says that fundraising by people like you is an absolute lifeline for the charity and really enables them to continue their research into spotting signs of dementia and treating it years and years before the symptoms show. It's possible, isn't it, Frank, if everybody tries a bit, the difference we can make as individuals, as you've shown, is massive, isn't it?
It is. You're absolutely right. And what I've done, I hope, will make a difference. And it will make a difference to mankind, you know, as they find things out through research. It's not kept as a secret for the association. It's distributed worldwide, so it will help all mankind. And it's nice to do something that will help mankind. I think there's a lot of people, most people, are looking for something to do to make a difference, whether it's locally, whether it's in their own little community, or worldwide. And I've been lucky that I found something that I wanted to do. It was a real challenge, got loads of people interested, got loads and loads of followers, and as a result, we've made a massive difference to the awareness of Alzheimer's and to the funds that they need to research it. I'm very lucky there.
And what are your memories, Frank, of coming in and seeing your family waiting for you? Take me back to that moment. It must have been so special and emotional.
Oh, it was to see people on the course, and they're just dots. But my wife, she has a lovely pair of red jeans. Nobody else wears red jeans. We had a team shirt, so I could see this person stood on the shore there in red jeans and a white shirt. I thought, that's Judith, you know, and I could pick her out. And it was slowly as I got close and close, I could see her properly. So I stood up in the water and says, "Get my tea on that table, woman." Which is our little joke we have, you know.
What were you most looking forward to once you got back?
Oh, cool drink, that not necessarily a beer. I love beer, like I love beer, but I wanted a cool drink, something like a Diet Coke or a lime and lemonade, something with loads of icing, because everything I'd eaten and drunk over the last 56 days had been at 25 degrees. It doesn't get very, the temperature doesn't change very much during the night. It doesn't get less than 25 degrees at night. So everything I've been drinking and eating was 25 degrees, and I wanted something really sharp and cold. I was really looking forward to that.
And were you looking forward to a good night's sleep? Because I'm just wondering how much sleep you actually got per day.
Usually didn't sleep during the day. I just kept on going. I would break the day up into probably three or four segments and try and make that a three-hour segment, and then stop for 20 minutes and have lunch or whatever else I needed to, or calls, phone calls. I got myself wedged in. The boat's rocking and rolling. It's rocking from left to right, and it's also pitching nose down and nose up. So you're going in every direction.
Now, we have established that you are a bit of an explorer. Tell me a bit about the stuff you did with Bear Grylls.
Actually, I didn't do anything with Bear Grylls. Bear Grylls promoted a television series called The Island, where he put people from different backgrounds together on an island, just left them there with an axe, 20 litres of water and a penknife, and I'll see you in 5 weeks' time. On the time I went, he had some old people and young people. The old people were all over 35, and I was 67.
And the you were 67 years young, is what you mean.
No, I'm an old codger.
So how was it?
But I'm an extremely practical person. I can make anything. At the moment, I'm building a steam traction engine from scratch, a full-size one. It's where it's 6 tons when it's done. And as you can see, I've got my boiler suit on now. So I'm in the garage. Oh. You've stopped me from working today.
I'm sorry about that. You're looking very smart in your boiler suit.
I'm fitting the chimney at the moment. I can make anything, you know, anything at all. I can look after myself, but we have to look after the group. And I found cutting wood to be pretty easy, but everybody else found it really, really difficult. You know, they were in blisters on their hands, and it would take me 2 minutes to cut through a big log. You know, it would take about half an hour. So I decided that what I would do is, instead of leading from the front, because there was resentment against me from the younger people for me leading, so I decided I'll lead from the back and I'll just provide the firewood, which is what I did. And every day I had two things. I did firewood, and every day I went and got coconuts. They couldn't get coconuts out of the trees, but I made a big pole, and every day I got 6 coconuts down right the way through there. On week 4, the organisers threw the cameramen that were placed opposite the position. They were told to tell us that we'd run out of fish hooks or small fish hooks. So the only fish hooks we had were large fish hooks, and to catch anything large, we're going to have to go out into the sea. So these two lads from London says, "Oh, yeah, we'll build a raft, we'll build a raft." So, oh, yeah, they've no chance. So I thought, well, I won't interfere, let them get on with it. Well, they'd absolutely no idea. First thing they did, they cut down a mahogany tree, which doesn't float. You know, it just bobs on the board. No way is it going to carry any weight. And that took them all day. And then the next day, they spent all day arguing whether they were going to sit on it once they'd made it. So one of the camera people came up to me. She says, "Why don't you build a raft?" I said, "Well," I says, "they're doing it. You know, let them get on with it." "No," she says, "but you could do it, couldn't you?" "Oh, yeah, of course I could, yeah." I said, "but I wouldn't do it here. I'd do it a mile down the coast where all that bamboo is." I said, "because bamboo floats." So she says, "well, tomorrow we'll go and you and me." Oh, I said, "I don't want anybody else to get involved in it, because we want to stop the job and start doing it their way." And they've no idea. Went down the coast and I built a pontoon for one of the pontoons for the raft I was going to make. So I decided to make it into a canoe instead, like a Hawaiian canoe with an outrigger. That day, it was cold, it was raining hard. So I made the two paddles with a machete, and it came time to launch it, but it was 4:30. And the safety side of things meant that we couldn't go swimming after 5 o'clock. We couldn't use machetes after 5 o'clock. If we were going to go swimming, we had to go and tell one of the embedded camera people had to radio the safety boat, and the safety boat would come and stand off just in case somebody got washed away, because a bit of tidal current there. So anyway, I suggested we'll launch it tomorrow. No, she said, "we've got to launch it today." I says, "you better get a safety boat around here." She says, "well, it won't be here for an hour." I says, "well, it's only around, go on." Anyway, okay, I'll do what she says. You know, all of a sudden, 3 boats came around the corner, 3 speed boats with like 30 people, and they got all the people off the production island, editors and the producers, and they'd come because nobody ever managed to make a boat that had worked before. Nobody ever made a canoe. So me and this lady, we then launched the boat, and She then filmed me paddling it out, and then she went and put the camera on the beach. She came out and swam on the boat, and so we both paddled it the mile up the beach. And it was the first time we were ever directed where they like sex conflict, that type of thing. So they wanted to splash me, which she did do. She splashed me, and I splashed her back. And then they says, "Jump on his back." Well, so she stood up on there and she jumped on my back, and I got one of her bosoms out of my left ear and one of her bosoms on my right ear. And I'm making rude gestures to these things, you know, and they're filming it, you know, and we get the boat and we get it to the beach where we have our camp. The rest of the islanders are all cheering us in. They use that in the trailer, but they didn't show it on the programme. I think the demographics, I think it's the right word, of the people they're selling the programme to was a younger audience, and they don't want to see an old bloke doing better than younger people. That's not doing what the advertisers wanted. When it was broadcast, I felt I was edited out of episode 3 and 4 because that's where they were put the boat scene, I believe. So they didn't show it after all that.
Oh, no, after all that effort. Just tell me, Frank, just to finish with, I mean, where does this adventuresome spirit come from? Is it your childhood or, you know, or whatever you've done as a living?
I know what it's like to do without. I know what it's like to be poor. I know what it's like to be skint. And now I have my own business, I employ 40 people. And last year we decided it was best if I left, which I'm really happy about. So it's given me the opportunity to do other things. And it always seemed to be, when I was a kid, it always seemed to be the other kids that had things and I didn't. So now I want to do it now, you know.
Just tell me about the engine you're building.
It's a Foster Wellington. What happened is in about 1900 and turn of the century, 1910, the steam traction engines that were ploughing the fields got bigger and bigger. And some of these farmers were using these steam traction engines for haulage. And the bridges couldn't carry the weight. The bridges were collapsing and they were wrecking the roads. So the government brought a law in that on the road, the biggest steam traction you could have was a 5-tonner. And it had to be driven by one man. And this is one of these 5-tonners. So as steam traction engines go, it's a smaller version of a steam traction engine. It's still a full-size one. And it's obviously it's powered by coal. And it's going to take me probably 2, 3, 4, 5 years to do it. I just don't know. It depends how much time I've got. But I've done other things. I built one as a kit. And I took the engine out of it and I put it in a Land Rover. So I have the only coal-fired Land Rover in the world. I like driving that around the town.
It looks like Thomas the Tank Engine. Why does that not surprise me, Frank?
I call it Mildred. I have a picture of Judith I put on the front of it, so it looks like a Thomas the Tank Engine piece of kit.
Do you know what? The only thing that's missing from this podcast, I'll have to meet Judith one day. She sounds an absolute legend. You've got your boiler suit on. I'm going to let you go and have a cup of tea with Judith. Honestly, it's been amazing chatting to you, Frank. Thanks ever so much for sharing your adventure in the Atlantic.
Yet.
Oh, you've not finished. What else are you telling me?
I'm going to row the Atlantic again in 2023.
Oh.
But this time, I'm going to do it in less than 49 days because the women's record is 49 days. So at 70, I'm going to be the oldest man and also faster than the fastest woman.
Wow. I like your ambition. You're not taking me with you for this, are you? It's solo again, I'm guessing.
No, I'm going to do it solo, but I'm looking for a woman to go with me to a match race across the Atlantic. It'll encourage her to keep at it, beat the ladies' record, and also I'll be wanting to prove that men are stronger than women.
On that note, before you get hit over the head with Judith's handbag, I'm going to let you get on with your building. You've been a great interviewee. Thank you so much for your time.
Helen, thank you very much for giving me the opportunity.
You've been listening to Frank Rothwell, who rode the Atlantic by himself at the age of 70, raising £1 million for Alzheimer's Research UK, inspired by his brother-in-law Roger's battle with dementia. Thanks for listening to Frank's story. You can download and subscribe to our series at convex.podbean.com or search The Convex Conversation on Spotify, Apple and Google Podcasts, or ask Alexa. See you next week. Bye for now.